I always know when a big holiday shopping weekend is coming because there are sales everywhere telling me to shop now or miss out. But when I shop at Bob's Discount Furniture, I never have to miss out because Bob's has the latest summer styles at everyday low prices. Plus, Bob's has tons of real five-star reviews for me to rely on, which is how I found a real marble elm dining set with over 600 five-star reviews, the Copper Radiance mattress, which over 400 Bob's customers say will give you five-star sleep, the ultra-comfy Phantom reclining sofa, which boasts over 1,000 five-star reviews, and the customizable modular Bob's sectional, which not only costs just $250 per piece, but has over 1,700 five-star reviews. So when you're ready to skip the holiday weekend gimmicks and score five-star style for every room in your home, listen to the smartest shoppers around and shop at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Nerds. Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Ever Google a money question and end up 12 tabs deep with 12 different answers? This podcast is your shortcut back to clarity. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast breaks down financial decisions with a team of trusted journalists. They explain the why behind decisions like investing, home buying, and choosing credit cards with clear, research-backed insights. No jargon, no misinformation. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Game day at my place is kind of a big deal. If I'm grilling, chilling, and watching hoops, my outdoor patio setup better be ready to play. That's where Wayfair wins. From patio seating and umbrellas to grills and grilling accessories, Wayfair's got it all, and it shows up fast. I'm talking championship level, fast and easy delivery. So level up your grill game and your outdoor chill game and head to Wayfair.com now to get your outdoor space ready for the season.
Basketball, a game of giants. And there's number 99, George Mikan, one of the greatest.
Perhaps the most complete player the game has ever seen. The Lakers captain, Elgin Baylor.
2 seconds, 1 second. West throws it up.
Jerry West made it from the other side of the mid-court stripe.
Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win.
Magic down the middle, just what I thought. A hook shot at 12. Good!
Shaquille fadeaway.
Giants for the win.
Bang!
James puts up the three.
Oh, it's good.
Doncic on the drive. Step back. Puts it up. Puts it in. With 5 tenths of a second remaining.
What's up, Laker fans? You're listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. I'm Pete, joined by Darius. And the New York Knicks have been the first team to punch their ticket to the 2026 NBA Finals, winners of 11 straight playoff games, something that's rarely ever happened in NBA history, D. They are on a hot streak that's rarely ever seen. My dad's side of the family, they're all from New York. I grew up around a lot of New Yorkers and several Knicks fans. They're sort of the consistently my second favorite team, I think, in the NBA, just in terms of if my team ain't in it, they're going to be a default team that I root for. They are on a heater right now, man, and they just swept the Cleveland Cavaliers. A little bit later, I want to talk about, I think both the Knicks and Cavs have interesting, like, Lakers front office and team building applications that I want to get into with you. But for now, man, what's going on with the Knicks?
What's going on is they look like one of the best teams in the history of the world, basically. The ESPN folks have been talking about this a fair amount, but they're on a heater of the likes that no one's ever seen and that no one's ever really accomplished in the NBA, period. Apparently, Pete, I think they've outscored opponents by like 260-something points or 270-something points over this stretch of 11 straight wins. That's the largest point differential for any 11-game win streak ever.
Incredible.
Regular season or playoffs. And so the degree to which they've just been kicking teams' asses has been ridiculous. This game was over basically like after the first period. They were up double digits again, got up to 20-something in the second quarter. The Cavs made like a quasi-push to get it back under 20, and then the Knicks just closed the door. By the time everyone went out on both sides, there was like 6 or 7 minutes left in the game, and it was like a 22 or 23-point game. They ended up winning by 30-something points again.
And the Cavs certainly contributed with their efforts or lack thereof.
When the coffin is open and they went and laid down is basically what happened. But the degree to which they got kicked in the face over and over and over again will cause you to lay down. This is what they did to Atlanta. Mm-hmm. It's what they did to Philly. There's a dispiriting that's happening to Knicks opponents that I don't think it's going to happen in the finals in terms of them being able to sort of dispirit their opponents. But Cleveland went to this zone in game four. It was sort of their last grasp at trying to slow them down. That worked for maybe 8 or 9 possessions, mm-hmm. where the Knicks looked a little bit flustered, weren't exactly sure where their shots were going to come from. And then they just said, oh, well, you know what? We'll just start getting out in transition again, inbounding quickly, racing the court, and we'll score that way. And then it's 20-something points again, and Donovan Mitchell was shooting the ball well and whatever. The Cavs had absolutely no shot in this game at all. And the Knicks have come together. Great vibes. They're sharing the ball. Their best player in Brunson is showing a level of shot making that is just elite, elite stuff. We talk about Shea or some of the stuff Wemby's been doing, Luka, Durant, top level. Give this guy an angle,
yeah,
and him being able to make a shot. I just named Luka's a 6'8", 6'7", wing. Durant's basically a 7-foot guard, essentially, the way that he plays. Wemby, 7'5". Shea's another big guard. Brunson's, what, 6'1"?
Yeah, remarkable. Master of footwork and angles and all the different skills. Yeah.
Hesitation, yeah. Speed changes, acceleration, deceleration, left-right stuff. And his touch and shot making is just sublime. The degree to which every role player is locked in, it's just been a great run. Even their bench players. Landry Shamet went 11 for 12 or 12 for 13 from three. Unbelievable. Yeah, just could not miss. The last run I saw or that I remember, and as a Lakers fan, I especially remember this, was when D. Fish went 15 for 20 in
2001.
The 2001 playoff conference finals against the Spurs. So we went 15 for 20 in a 4-game sweep of the Spurs. And I remember thinking every time Fish shot that the shot was going in. Well, that is basically what Shamet did. He missed once from beyond the arc the entire series and not on 4 or 5 attempts, on double-digit attempts. It's truly unreal what they're doing. And hats off to them. It's hard to win in the playoffs, and they have made it look absolutely ridiculously easy, the way that they've just stomped these teams out.
Their competition level has not been super high, but this is exactly what you're supposed to do to that type of competition level if you're a legit team. Sorry, you're protesting.
No, I'm just saying it's not like they're playing tanking teams. These are the playoffs.
For sure.
You know what I mean? And Cleveland, they're not hurt. They're a good team.
They're also not going out this way for the first time.
They're not. And there's a leadership question I have about the Cavs internally across multiple coaching staffs now, where it's just like, oh, okay, maybe it's not Kenny Atkinson. And I get it. They haven't played OKC or a San Antonio level team or whatever, or even like a Denver level team, sure, whatever, like a team that was considered like an inner sort of core contender. That said, what they did to the Hawks in mm-hmm. their closeout game, what they did to Philly in their closeout game, and what they did to Cleveland in this closeout game, they haven't played the best team, sure. They've also made these teams look like the Washington Generals.
Absolutely. Yeah, total devastation.
These guys have nothing for us, and we're putting our foots on their neck. It's just impressive.
Well, you were talking about sort of the getting the other team's spirit to go away. And one of the ways the Knicks did that is a commitment to running. I made an offside video today on that being one of the takeaways from the Spurs and OKC series, is just the degree of, we're going to go right away and just see if we have something. And because it's so hard to score in the 5-on-5 settings of half court, that whenever you can get cheap points, there was a point in that game four that the Knicks were on pace for like 60 points in transition. It was just unbelievable, right? They were off of makes, off of everything. They're really looking to run and everybody's really committed to it. So even if you get that early offense three and someone pulls up and they front rim it, you're here comes Cat flying in for a putback jam. You know, everybody's following up. Everybody's doing their job. And it's has this like wave after wave type of effect that it's one thing to say, yeah, we want to take their spirit and make them give up, right? But it's quite another thing to be able to do that. And I think there was a relentlessness to how they run. And that speaks to sort of the level of their top end talent. And then the couple of guys off their bench. Like for me, one of the takeaways from a Lakers perspective is their closing five is really good. If you think about their, you know, what's that? Brunson, Cat, OG, Bridges, who was amazing this series, and Josh Hart. Mm-hmm. Who's the worst player in that group? Josh? Josh is a really good player. Like that's sort of that weak link theory is like you're only as good as your worst player on the court. And like some days that's going to be Josh, and some days it'll be Bridges. But like you were saying earlier, Brunson is super steady as a shot creator. Like you can really rely on him from night after night. They've got a dude on the interior that can also space the floor for everybody, two really legit two-way wings. And yeah, just there's a completeness to their team. Let's go to break here. Come back. Keep it going.
I always know when a big holiday shopping weekend is coming because there are sales everywhere telling me to shop now or miss out. But when I shop at Bob's Discount Furniture, I never have to miss out because Bob's has the latest summer styles at everyday low prices. Plus, Bob's has tons of real five-star reviews for me to rely on, which is how I found a real marble elm dining set with over 600 five-star reviews, the Copper Radiance mattress, which over 400 Bob's customers say will give you five-star sleep, the ultra-comfy Phantom reclining sofa, which boasts over 1,000 five-star reviews, and the customizable modular Bob sectional, which not only costs just $250 per piece, but has over 1,700 five-star reviews. So when you're ready to skip the holiday weekend gimmicks and score five-star style for every room in your home, listen to the smartest shoppers around and shop at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Nerds.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Personal finance can feel like a pop quiz you didn't study for. This podcast is your study guide. On NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast, you'll hear from trusted journalists who explain the why behind major financial decisions. You'll get research-backed insights and clear pros and cons, whether you're planning a big purchase or just want to grow your wealth. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Game day at my place is kind of a big deal. If I'm grilling, chilling, and watching hoops, my outdoor patio setup better be ready to play. That's where Wayfair wins. From patio seating and umbrellas to grills and grilling accessories, Wayfair's got it all, and it shows up fast. I'm talking championship level fast and easy delivery. So level up your grill game and your outdoor chill game and head to Wayfair.com now to get your outdoor space ready for the season.
Even their bench players, Pete, the competitiveness they're showing defensively, I get it. OG is a all-defense level player. And Bridges, I think, certainly has some matchups for him are better than others. But historically, he's been looked at as almost a prototypical 3-and-D wing. Josh Hart is just competitive as they come. He's undersized as a forward or whatever, but got a great nose for the ball, just fights hard defensively. But off of the bench, Deuce McBride be out here fighting defensively. Landry Shamet, the sort of leap that he's made as a defensive player, just the, I'm going to get after it, I'm going to pressure the ball. And then Mitchell Robinson to me is like, you know, big sort of burly, strong defensive presence, big. Good rim protector. He's good on the glass on both sides. Yeah.
Relentless, right? He fits into that whole, like, we're going to be relentless after the ball. Like, yeah.
Yeah, great motor. All of those guys just get after it. It was during that stretch of this season when the Lakers were really struggling defensively. And where you and I were wondering about, well, where's the culture of this team to sort of step up and start to do things on this side of the ball? If it's normal for you to just get blown by and then take the ball out of the net and try to go score the other way, this is how that looks. And I remember commenting to you, I get it that the personnel is not necessarily there but the fight is not there at all.
Yeah.
And to get from that point to where the Lakers closed the season defensively, I want to say that that's like a great indicator of sort of where their culture actually was, and that they really did need to find a way to put it together. And they did. But Shamet to me is a perfect example in how Towns is playing defensively, what they're doing with Brunson in terms of not giving up switches and hedging and recovering and sort of commitment to a plan. These are lessons I think the Lakers should be taking as well from a series like this, where it's just like, look, I know that the Knicks have some great defensive personnel, but two of their five starters have not been known as good defensive players at all. In fact, they've been viewed historically as liabilities defensively.
And that's part of the reason why I think some of the lessons to be taken away are actually in the team building respect of, if we're starting from a Luka and Austin basis, okay, what do you need around that type of build to be able to thrive in the playoffs? I think there's some lessons to be learned with the Knicks there.
There definitely are. And I think that we've been talking about these for basically all season, right? In what Marcus Smart has provided, for example, and how the Lakers need to replicate that in more parts of their roster. But both conference finals should be an idea that the Lakers zoom in on, both because, A, the Western Conference, these two teams, look how great they are. What are they good at? What are the challenges around trying to beat them, and them serving as North Stars in different ways, too, in terms of, okay, well, you've got to be able to beat a team with Wemby, but you've also got to be able to beat a team with Shea. And how do you do that?
Yeah.
But a team like the Knicks, who we'll talk about the finals when the finals are actually set, but they are the sort of team build where the Lakers can look at them and say they didn't do it by tanking for straight years and getting a bunch of high lottery picks that end up being elite players for you who are on rookie scale deals. And it allows you to pay Isaiah Hartenstein $30-something million because Chet Holmgren only makes $9 million. That's not what the Knicks did, Pete.
It's not what the Knicks did, for sure. Although they did have some advantages as well, right? Like Brunson in the July 2024 contract extension, he took like $113 million less than he was eligible for, in part to be able to build a team. The Knicks didn't tank, right? And so I think there's a lot of similarities in terms of how the Lakers need to build and what they've done. One of the things too is they don't have any really dead money on their rotation, right? You don't see guys that are making $10, $11 million not in their rotation at all. They nailed the Shamet signing at a vet minimum. You've got Miles McBride, Deuce McBride, you know, as a second round pick a few years back, making $3.5 million, Alvarado contributing.
Mitchell Robinson was the same way. He was a second round pick as well.
Exactly. And so being able to sort of have that depth, you got to also acknowledge, though, that the top guy being like, no, I'm going to take a lot less to be able to facilitate a team build, that helps a lot too.
He took a lot less after he had already proven that he was elite. His first deal that he signed was an under-market deal, but not at the very beginning because no one knew he was going to be this good.
No, I remember. It's easy to look at it with the, you know, hindsight being 2020, but at the time, it was the, oh, should Dallas have kept him or not? And he ends up moving on. But yeah, in retrospect, it looks different.
Dallas got lambasted for not being able to keep him.
Yeah.
They basically had him. Could have signed him to a sort of mid-level deal, the sort of deal that Austin Reeves got originally, right? Which was like, okay, well, you were a second-round pick, essentially. You're Arenas rule, sort of like, we can give you a raise, but it's only going to be for this much. And Brunson was willing to sign that all the way up through the trade deadline of his walk year. Dallas didn't get it done. They were sort of cold feet about the whole thing. And that was the year that Luka ended up getting hurt to start the playoffs, and he missed the first couple of games. And Brunson went off against the Jazz and got them in a position to win the series without Luka. And it was just like, oh shit, did we mess this up? And then he goes to New York and plays for Tibbs and his dad. He's known Tibbs his entire life. His dad is on the coaching staff, but the contract he signed was like, I think 4 years and $100 million or a little bit over $100 million. And people were like, is this too much money for Jalen Brunson? I know that he's shown that he can do some things, but he's mostly been a backup. It's unclear if he can sort of reach that level. Well, it wasn't unclear for long. He ended up being awesome, and then he took less. But the way that the Knicks have been able to sort of trade into better fitting pieces around Brunson, that's the real story.
The trades.
Mm-hmm. I get that Brunson made less money, but just because he wasn't on a max didn't mean, like, the Knicks never had cap space. They never went into an offseason the way that the Lakers are now, essentially, like they did in the Brunson year. But after that, it was, no, we've got to build around a team that is above the cap. What they did is they had already signed Randall. So they had Randall. They signed DiVincenzo on a mid-level deal. They traded a guy that they had drafted in Emmanuel Quickly and used him as the centerpiece to get OG Anunoby. And Anunoby had had some injury issues or whatever. And then they go all in for Bridges. And the deal then where they swap out Randall and DiVincenzo for Towns, that was sort of like who won the trade. Minnesota made runs to the conference finals themselves with Randall and DiVincenzo being critical pieces in that. But Towns' ability as like a ceiling raiser has just been fantastic for them. And his numbers aren't all NBA level Towns the way that he was in like Minnesota or whatever. But his floor spacing and ability to rebound, I think, has been critical to everything that New York is doing right now. And the sort of shift to him being a hub player within their offense in different parts throughout these playoffs has been the sort of counterbalance to Brunson's brilliance as a one-on-one talent.
There's a great deal of value in players that can put pressure on the basket from different places and in different ways. So Cat's both spacing and shooting ability opens the floor up for everybody. It creates better cutting lanes. It helps, like, a guy like OG, for example, loves to go through a player and just freaking dunk on him if he can. It's a lot easier if there isn't that second player that's digging down on you, trying to strip it away, and you've just got that clear one-on-one. And a guy like Cat helps facilitate that, both as a passer, but just simply his presence as a jump shooter. But he's also a big dude that will rack a closeout and get all the way to the basket and finish at the rim. He will rebound in double digits and is able to put pressure on the boards on both ends of the floor. And so that variety, despite him not putting up those same type of numbers as before, I think that his ability to do that, and then when he is bought in defensively and, hell yeah, I'm going to run the floor and do everything that I can do to help execute a plan. They're a great example of, if you've got a guard like Brunson, you're never going to be able to be a great switching team just because the other team's always going to pick Brunson. And at some point, you're going to have to double and all of that. Well, okay, what are the defensive coverages we can run, knowing that this guy is essential to what we do? And we've got a big guy in Cat that is not necessarily the best thing that he does either. What can we do? And let's get good at that. And so I think they're a great example of that. Let's go to break here, come back and talk about, keep this going. And I'd love to talk about what your thoughts on where the Cavs go from here.
I always know when a big holiday shopping weekend is coming because there are sales everywhere telling me to shop now or miss out. But when I shop at Bob's Discount Furniture, I never have to miss out because Bob's has the latest summer styles at everyday low prices. Plus, Bob's has tons of real 5-star reviews for me to rely on, which is how I found a real marble elm dining set with over 600 5-star reviews, the Copper Radiance mattress, which over 400 Bob's customers say will give you 5-star sleep, the ultra comfy Phantom reclining sofa, which boasts over 1,000 5-star reviews, and the customizable modular Bob sectional, which not only costs just $250 per piece, but has over 1,700 5-star reviews. So when you're ready to skip the holiday weekend gimmicks and score 5-star style for every room in your home, listen to the smartest shoppers around and shop at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Nerds. Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Ever Google a money question and end up 12 tabs deep with 12 different answers? This podcast is your shortcut back to clarity. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast breaks down financial decisions with a team of trusted journalists. They explain the why behind decisions like investing, home buying, and choosing credit cards with clear, research-backed insights. No jargon, no misinformation. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Game day at my place is kind of a big deal. If I'm grilling, chilling, and watching hoops, my outdoor patio setup better be ready to play. That's where Wayfair wins. From patio seating and umbrellas to grills and grilling accessories, Wayfair's got it all, and it shows up fast. I'm talking championship level, fast and easy delivery. So level up your grill game and your outdoor chill game and head to Wayfair.com now to get your outdoor space ready for the season.
Did you hear the Draymond Green rant the other day about
Harden?
About defending and Harden and
yeah, it was great. There was a certain, this is part of one of the best things about Draymond is like, there's a certain, no, we're not going to allow this. We're not going to stand for this. That's part of a spirit and culture of a team that you can't get beat the same way over and over again and just tolerate it.
And for those who didn't hear what Draymond said, it was in the aftermath of Jalen Brunson essentially torching the Cavs down the stretch of game one, where Cleveland just kept switching and giving up the switch to allow Jalen Brunson to attack James Harden. And Draymond was basically incredulous at this idea that the Cavs would just continue to switch Harden into a matchup where, to use Draymond's words, that's not James Harden's job to defend this guy. There are other players on your team who you pay to do that job. And those players essentially switching out and having Harden be the guy that's up top, he's like, we would never do that with Steph. Teams are trying to target Steph, stuff like that. We wouldn't allow it. And I was reminded of that just in that same series, watching the Knicks do everything they could to not allow Brunson to be targeted over and over and over again. You could tell they were fine with Brunson defending Harden. Harden's in his 17th season now. He's older. It's like he's big and he's strong, but he's not as fast and he's not as shifty. Brunson being able to essentially stay in front. And if Harden's going to shoot these little mid-range jumpers over the top of him, I think the Knicks were totally willing to live with that. But watch how the Knicks were not allowing them to get Mitchell on to Brunson. And they were like hedging and recovering and doing all of this stuff in order to not allow Brunson to get isolated. And it made me think of the Lakers. It made me think of how many times the Lakers have consistently just switched into a disadvantageous matchup for Luka or for Austin and then doubled if they had to. And like, there's a resourcefulness that I appreciated about the Lakers, but Draymond's comments did make me think about like, why are you just switching Luka in to this, that, and the other defensive matchup? Now, I guess part of it is the Lakers didn't have Mikal Bridges and OG Anunoby and Josh Hart to sort of be like, well, no, we want these guys in these matchups and that's that. And like, maybe there's not a huge difference between Rui and Austin and Luka, but it was interesting to me.
I actually think it's more about the big man spot. I think it's a lack of trust in the Lakers fives to be able to execute the different versions of drops and showing the level of the ball. I feel like Redick felt like he had gotten burned by trying to do that earlier in the year, and that's how the Lakers became a switchier team as the year went on. And they became more effective at that because it's a simpler thing to be able to do, especially over the course of 82. And so that's one of the things I want to have this conversation this week with you, actually, on what do we want out of the five spot? Because another thing, one of my takeaways from watching San Antonio OKC is I think one of the ways to beating San Antonio, it's so simple, but it makes sense, is that you have to be able to go five out against them at least a decent amount of the time. And when I say that, I mean just five players that can shoot or some freakish player that could put just a ton of pressure on the rim at one of those spots, right? But that ability to space the floor, and it just makes sense in that if everything about your offense sort of is based around meeting Wemby at the rim, that has a ceiling on it. And you have to be able to space the floor a little bit. And I thought San Antonio made some great adjustments in game four in terms of how they made Shea be more of the player that needed to beat them, but also not letting him get the touch in the first place. I think OKC being it without a Jalen Williams and AJ Mitchell is really sort of playing out there. But anyway, a lot of places there, D. But yeah, I think there's a lot to be learned from what we're watching right now.
I think both from a strategy standpoint and from a team building standpoint. So I do want to pivot back to like the Eastern Conference because, the Western Conference Finals could be three more games of this.
Yeah, we're going to watch that tonight. Yeah.
But you said you wanted to talk about the Cavs a little bit, and I'd love to get into the Cavs a little bit. Where's your head at around them? They were the most expensive team this season. They had the highest payroll. I think they were the only team that closed the season in the second apron. They pay essentially two players the max. Harden is a very expensive player. Jared Allen's a very expensive player relative to like the center position. And then they've got a bunch of role players who didn't quite fit together as much. And it seemed like a very revolving door of who's going to be the fifth guy who can play next to these guys. Oh, maybe it's Dean Wade. Maybe it's Max Strus. Maybe it's Sam Merrill. Oh, let's go smaller. Maybe it's Dennis Schroeder. Like, you know, and over and over and over again, they were searching, it felt like, and they never found it. And now they exit in a whimper in the conference finals. And their owners on Twitter, basically like, we're going to do better. And I'm wondering, how do they do it?
Yeah. I think they need a total rebuild in a lot of ways. If you're asking me the reasons why they go out in a bit of a whimper, you know, their shot creators are in Harden and Mitchell are not good on the defensive end, their targets. And so it's one thing to have one Brunson that's flanked by OG and Bridges and Josh and at least competent fives. It's quite another to have two problems on the court at the same time. There are some Laker applications to this. I think Luka and Austin are definitely better collectively on defense than Harden and Mitchell, but there are some things to be learned from that. D, you know me well as somebody you've talked basketball with almost every day for 10 years. Who's the player in the NBA that triggers me the most?
Oh, I know where you're going with this. Is he a forward, Pete, that plays for the Cleveland Cavaliers?
He is. I have smoke for strange players around the league.
Yes, you do.
I am Evan Mobley's number one hater. I don't generally spend my time on the podcast hating on players. It's not really what I want the pod to be. And it's not really about hating on Evan Mobley even. It's about, I think that the coverage of him has been crazy. And I think he's a good starting caliber player, two-way caliber player, who's paid like a superstar. He's owed like $225 million over the next 4 years. And there are two players in the league where I feel like all of you are gaslighting me. Everybody I talk to is messing with me about this, right? The fans, you're in on it too, that it's Evan Mobley and to a lesser extent, I'll admit, Herb Jones, where I swear every time I watch their games, we're supposed to trade multiple picks for him. Anyhow, with Mobley, with the money issues that they're in, if I were them, I would be looking to move him as long as there is enough of the league under a spell that he's like a budding superstar, that you can get that type of value. You can resolve your financial issues. You can get some picks. That would be the direction that I go. I would not build around Harden, but Brian Windhorst is saying that it's pretty certain that he's going to decline his options so that he can sign in Cleveland long term. There's also some connective tissue with LeBron. If LeBron comes back next year, he said that the things that he'd be determining that off of were his and his family's comfort. That makes me think of two places more than anywhere else. And the only other one than LA is Cleveland, right? So I don't know. I think there's a lot of interesting storylines between Lakers and Cleveland.
I'm a bit higher on Mobley than you are, but I totally see where you are coming from. The fact that he's got like a DPOY under his belt and like Anthony Davis doesn't, disgusting, for example, grinds my gears. And I thought that Mobley showed he was up for it on certain nights. But overall, I don't think that he's the shot creator. I don't think that he's the rebounder. I don't think that he's the shooter. In our text thread, I've been referring to him as the LeBron James of Derek McKee's.
Uh-huh.
And for those who are unfamiliar with Derek McKee was a longtime forward in the NBA. He played with the Supersonics for a while, and then he closed the meaningful part of his career with the Pacers. And he was on the Pacers team that went to the finals and played the Lakers. And McKee was often a very tantalizing player because he was tall, he was a multifaceted and multi-skilled player, but he didn't have that sort of like meanness and oomph to his game that would sort of activate all of the tools that he had in his toolbox. And so he was a guy that I always felt like, man, if he really had that x-ray with the dog that's in the chest, he would have been a guy who was like a 20 and 10 sort of dude. But instead, he was more like a 12 and 5 or kind of guy.
As a hater, I watch him and I'm like, that's a brick. Like, you ever do that when you're watching the game and a player takes a shot? You're like, hell no, that's not going in.
You sound like that KG clip. That's that KG clip.
That's absolutely me watching Evan Mobley play basketball. Like, he'll take a three and just, I know the way that he steps into a shot, I'm going to be like, that shit's off. He's really skinny, not have a dog in him. I think that's just partially he doesn't have a lot of force.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a lot on his frame, and a lot of his moves are sort of pivot away from the contact and all of that. I mean, there's a reason he's never averaged 20 a game, but he's making $55 million a year over the next 4 years.
And the thing that stood out to me in this series and sort of grounding it back into how good is he? To me, he needs to then dominate on defense. If you're going to make that much money, then how are the Knicks just dismantling you defensively?
Yeah, did you notice him defensively impacting the Knicks? No.
Jaren Jackson Jr. is a player who frustrates a lot of people for a variety of other reasons. And in a lot of ways, he's very similar to Mobley in that, like, the flaws in his game are very real and the limitations are very real, but he's paid like a superstar player. Jackson plays with more force and yada, yada, yada. And, like, I get it, but he fouls a shit ton and doesn't rebound. And it's just like, okay, like, what's your deal, bro? Like, you make $50 million a year. Like, why aren't you better than this? Jackson, I think, does impact the game defensively more than Mobley does because he is a stronger, more physical player and is a more active shot blocker around the rim. But very similarly, I find myself wanting with both of those players in ways where I'm just like, man, can this dude be a max level guy on your team and you be awesome? And I think to your point about the Cavs and their roster build, it's like they went to the basketball roster construction store and was just like, oh man, you're out of wings? All right, well, give me two of those guards. You're still out of wings. All right, well, then give me two kind of like centers that are sort of like can do different things. And they ended up with lineups. And I thought that this was especially true with, well, with Garland, but it still remains true with Harden. The best version of your team with your best players can't be when we stagger our guys.
The closing five idea, right? Your five got to be able to play together cohesively and be better than the other five that's out there. Yeah.
And this is where I like lament the injuries that essentially ended the Lakers season. They were starting to put it together in March in a way where it felt like, no, the five guys you start the game with and basically close the game with, that's working.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The thing that wasn't quite all the way there was the center rotation, right? Where some nights it might be Ayton, other nights it would be Jackson. And I think that that leads to what you said earlier in the pod that you want to have a discussion about, which is like, what do the Lakers actually need from the center spot, right? I get the Cavs are going to intrigue. I think they're going to continue to be like whispered as a potential LeBron landing spot. If for those who remember, James Harden was one of the fictional players on LeBron's list of guys who he would have been happy to, that they would have been able to bring to the team. He would have been willing to take a pay cut for, two summers ago. So that connective tissue is there, the way that you said, but I'm very intrigued by what the finals are going to look like, how the Western Conference finals are going to play out. But I'm also continue to be like, okay, Lakers, like what lessons can you learn from a team like the Knicks? What lessons can you learn from what happened to the Cavs? And what are not lessons, but what are your takeaways as a team that's trying to beat the two teams in the Western Conference Finals who both have separate MVP level ingredients? And it's just like, I don't think teams are built to stop both of those guys.
Very much so. All right. Please join me tonight on Offside. We've got the Stream Assistant really live and ready to go. At least this next version of it made the updates, made the sign-in a lot easier. So you could use that on your desktop. It's really customizable, whether it's the box score, the different ways you want to track a game. It's really cool. Really want to encourage you to check that out over on Offside. Be there tonight for Game 5. Good to be back after a few days off. We've got plenty more to talk about. Lakers made a hiring. We'll talk about that, I think, a little bit tomorrow as well. But until then, you've been listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
James has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. This pass out of front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
And Magic got it. Magic fires. It's good. And the Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound of Lottie. 3 seconds left. Van Exel to win it. It's on the way. Good!
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. has an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me?
Unreal.
Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Pretty pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move. Two, one.
Miss it.
Bryant. Unbelievable.
It's over.
Shot clock now to five.
Bryant.
Yes.
And that was a little tap to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers. James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.
Nerds.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Personal finance can feel like a pop quiz you didn't study for. This podcast is your study guide. On NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast, you'll hear from trusted journalists who explain the why behind major financial decisions. You'll get research-backed insights and clear pros and cons, whether you're planning a big purchase or just want to grow your wealth. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.